How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
Hello and welcome to the 14th episode of the Raining Jays podcast. With Jay King, I'm John Corrales. Since we last spoke, the Celtics have had two very tough losses to the Grizzlies and the Knicks, and wins over the Indiana Pacers and last night the Phoenix Suns. And last night the shots were falling. Jay King, for once, the shots were falling.
Well, in the first half they fell.
Yeah.
And then second half, yeah, you know. At this point, you know, a half of good offense is heaven. So, absolutely, you'll take it when you get it. Two straight wins. They've bounced back, finally, after a rough, rough stretch where they were just handing away games. And things are starting to look a little bit up again.
Well, last night, the three-pointers were falling. They were 14 of 30 from three. For a team that's hitting about 32% for the season, and can't stop shooting like 30 or 40 of them a game. They're just going high volume on the three-pointers. And it was nice to see against the Pacers the game that was starting to slip away just like everyone else, just like they were slipping away to the Knicks and just like they were slipping away to the Grizzlies, to turn around and to steal, literally, as Mike Gorman put it, steal a game with the defense down the stretch.
That I've never seen anything like that flurry of steals and breakaway dunks. Not once. I mean, four straight. I think there was maybe one Indiana possession in between. Other than that, four steals, four layups or dunks, and they turned a 3-point deficit into an 11 or 9-point win. That just doesn't happen in the NBA. It was like a CYO game. It was like an AAU game where you had like the top team in the state versus just some bums, just like ripping the ball away, going the other way. It was incredible. I thought Crowder, Smart, those guys made Amir Johnson. Those guys made some really incredible defensive plays down the stretch. You could see the first loose ball in that game. It was like Monte Ellis threw a pass away, and Jan Mahinmi was the closest to it. And Crowder and Bradley both beat him to the ball. And Crowder ended up getting it, going in for a dunk. And that was it. All she wrote. Pacers were done. Celtics were rising. And that was a fun, fun finish. Again, it was like their offense wasn't great. But their defense stepped up. And as Gorman said, as you said, they stole the win.
Yeah, and I think that was such a nice lesson for the team to learn. Because in those situations, they've just been relying on countering the other team's run by trying to hit the big shot, the three, the home run shot. For them to win with defense, to go on a huge, I think, what was it, 14-2 run to close the game with defense, that is a huge lesson, because that's something that Brad Stevens can go into the locker room and say, see, that's how you do it. You don't just try to go for the home run. That's how you do it. Stop them and you get easy baskets. That's how the Celtics, we've been saying it. You've been saying it on any podcast that you've been on. It's defense first, then you score. And then if you mix in some half court success, great. But if they're not scoring off their defense, then it's gonna take hitting half of your threes to beat a team like Phoenix last night.
Yeah, they need that defense to be productive going the other way. It's incredible how much better their offense looks when they're forcing turnovers.
Yeah, and they had 12 steals last night, so that's another huge thing. Let's talk about Kelly Olynyk, because in true Kelly Olynyk fashion, he was as bad as we've seen him against the Knicks. He was so bad against the Knicks. It was ridiculous. Looked lost, benched for the second half, and then he turns around and has a pretty productive game against the Pacers, and then a huge second quarter against Phoenix. So we went from the worst possible Kelly Olynyk that we could have to a pretty good to a great Kelly Olynyk, all in the span of a few games.
Yeah, I mean, against New York, he was bad enough on Kristaps Porzingis that Brad Stevens is like, you know what, to start the second half, we're going to start Marcus Smart, who gives up a foot to Porzingis on Porzingis. And then 2 days later, Olynyk's destroying the Suns. Like, just, they had gotten close, too. They pulled it within four, and then he responded with 13 points over the next 3 minutes, I believe. Hitting three threes, got to the hoop, did that funky reverse layup that did not look like a 7-footer move whatsoever. And he just has those moments where he looks so good. And it's why you're high about what he can be, because you see those stretches where he puts it together and he's drilling those threes and he's getting by guys and he's coming off screens and making plays. Like, no 7-footers do that. Nobody comes off like staggered screens to the perimeter as a 7-footer, and he can do that, and he can drive closeouts. He can do so many different things offensively. It's just, he has to be, I don't know whether it's aggressive or what, but it's just like some nights he just isn't flowing, and it's like all about the flow for him. If he's in the flow, he's really, really good, and if he's not, he can be awkward almost. So he's a huge part of what they do, because he can be so good offensively, because he is a guy that can space the floor, because he is a guy who can help others get their offense, because he stretches big guys away from the hoop. So anytime he's that good, it's huge for them, because he's one of the few guys on their team you really want shooting as many three-pointers as possible. Like, he is the guy, one of few, especially with Avery Bradley in a deep, deep slump at this stage, that you want him firing it up. And they need him to be engaged. They need him to be active. They need him to be aggressive. And if he could bring that every night, it'd be great. If he could bring it more often, they would settle for that. He can't float in and out of games like he does.
No, that's the thing. The performance last night is why I have said that he's borderline untouchable, because the things that he can bring to the game are so unique. And in this league, at this time of the league's history, he could be a perfect type of player. I mean, really, a 7-footer doing those things at the five, that is the dream scenario. Every team in the NBA is looking for a guy that can do the things that Kelly Olynyk does. But everybody's also looking for a guy to do those things on a nightly basis, not once every, you know, few games. Which, look, Olynyk is still on his rookie deal, and he's still a young guy, so we need to kind of take the step back and maybe the longer-term view. But last night, man, he was just catching and shooting. No hesitation, driving the ball and getting all the way to the hoop. It's just so nice to see. But here's a question that I asked, and it was answered a little bit with Olynyk, but I still want to bring it up for the show. Olynyk struggled in the second half against the Knicks. Brad Stevens decided to bench him. Is that the right move all the time? Or is it worth trying to let a guy like Olynyk work through those struggles in the second half? How many times can he be benched and have this be the response? He was benched and he responded well, and maybe that's just what he needs. Is that the thing that Stevens should be doing with everybody? Or should he be letting guys work through struggles and just keep the rotation where it is?
I mean, it depends who it is. I think Kelly Olynyk because he's so up and down, I don't know how, like, I don't know what the best way to deal with him is, because obviously you can't keep having him up and down. And it seems like there are full games where he's just not engaged, not ready to play, not that aggressive force you needed him to be. Is he best if you deal with him, you know, it doesn't matter, Kelly, we know you've struggled so far. Here, we're going to run plays for you, get you engaged. You're going to still be one of our go-to guys offensively. We need you. Or is it best to do what he did against New York and be like, you know what? Kelly just doesn't have it tonight. Let's move on. I don't know. And that's something hopefully they won't have to figure out, because hopefully Olynyk can just, you know, turn himself into a nightly steady contributor. But if he does continue the inconsistency, you have to figure out the proper way to react to it the nights when he's not good. I do want to spend a little time talking about Marcus Smart's defense on bigger guys lately, because him guarding Kristaps Porzingis, I don't know how sustainable that would have been for if they'd played it the whole second half. I don't know if Kristaps would have figured it out and started draining shots over Smart's head. But Smart is 6'4", maybe 6'3". Kristaps Porzingis is 7'2". A Latvian who is destroying the NBA in his rookie season. And Smart, like, it just punished him.
It was effective.
Was fronting him, giving him hell, pushing him away from the basket. That was just so much fun to watch. And then, of course, last night, Friday night against the Suns, Teletovic gets going, scores like a flurry of points. I think Jared Sullinger was guarding him. Sullinger has been eaten alive by Teletovic in the past. That's just not a good matchup for Sullinger. Celtics bring in Smart, giving up 6 inches this time to the Suns' power forward, and blocks him twice. Teletovic doesn't hit another field goal for the rest of the third quarter. Goes 0 for 5. Gets fouled a couple times, but whatever. You can live with that if he's going 0 for 5. I mean, the fact that Smart is guarding these guys is incredible. He's 6'3". Like, this guy, he's a guard, a point guard. And he's out there. There are very few guys who can guard legitimately 1 through 4. And Smart is kind of becoming a guy who can guard at least stretch fours.
Yeah.
Which is very, very impressive for a guy who's still 21 years old. And I just enjoy watching him do it. It's like he just loves the challenge. Loves the challenge. It's like Stevens calls on him to do it, and he's like, yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to guard this 7-2 guy. Like, I've been waiting to guard a center all my life.
He starts drooling.
Yeah.
You're right. You're right. And I love it. It almost reminded me of when Rondo was decided to guard LeBron in the playoffs against the Heat.
Yeah. Exactly like that.
It's that same kind of, you don't know how long it's going to last, but it's that little guy tenacity. Well, I mean, Smart's not a little guy, but compared to the guys he's guarding, he's a big guy. He's a little guy. But that tenacity that when you get that little bit of juice, you rise to the challenge of how am I going to get this big guy to stop killing us? And the thing about guarding a big guy like that, they hate when little guys are around them because you can't put the ball on the floor. There's no way, even if you catch the ball, you're not going to go by him. Teletovic wasn't going to drive by Marcus Smart because he'd just get ripped. Porzingis would in no way be able to drive by Smart. So Smart has that low base. You push the guys out. Even if they catch it and they turn, they'll have to hit a mid-range jumper over you. And that's still uncomfortable because you've got this annoying little guy around your legs that's making things not comfortable for you. So it's a real interesting little twist that Stevens is throwing out there. And being able to use Smart in an effective way when he's not shooting well. And he's not shooting well. He had the triple-double last night. He finally hit a three last night. He's shooting like 20% from three, yet he takes four a game. It's still, I don't know if he's still uncomfortable coming back in his role. He was the starter. Now he's coming off the bench. There's really, Isaiah Thomas is not going back to the bench. So, I don't know what's going on with Smart shooting, but when he's playing defense like this, you live with the other side because you can use him effectively to shut down guys that are starting to kill you.
Yeah, about his triple-double, that was, like, not the most beautiful triple-double. Like, I'm a big fan of triple-doubles, but, like, he
shot 4 of 12.
He shot 4 of 12. He took a couple bad threes, which he has a tendency to do. He made a few like lazy passes. It never felt like he was completely controlling the game. I mean, he played great defense. Absolutely played great defense. He was a menace against Phoenix and Teletovich, as we were talking about. It wasn't the most beautiful triple double. It was a promising performance, especially like where he's coming from and being kind of out of sorts since he came back from the injury. And right now, I just find it hard to gauge his development because, you know, he had the rookie season and he had some promising moments. Obviously, he needed to improve his offense. He had games earlier this season, like that San Antonio game. He was awesome. That Oklahoma City Thunder game, they were putting him in the post. He was just destroying people. Then he has the injury and he comes back and it's like out of sorts. He's kind of taken a little while to find that playmaking again. And I thought his game against Phoenix, though it wasn't the prettiest triple-double I've ever seen, it was definitely a step in the right direction. And hopefully he can continue to build on that because they do need him to continue to develop, to become more of a playmaker, especially when Isaiah Thomas is on the bench. And Isaiah Thomas has been fantastic lately. He scored 30-plus points in three straight games. He had 19 against Phoenix, even though he didn't play in the fourth quarter. He has just been killing people lately, and they need him to kill people. But they also need that secondary playmaker, and they need Smart to develop both as a playmaker and as a shooter. He's now at 14.8% in January. 14.8% from the three-point arc. That's not going to cut it. Right now, the Celtics have three rotation guards. Rotation guards who are shooting 15% or less from the three-point arc for the month of January. Avery Bradley, 6.3% from deep over the last five games. He finally got one to go down against Phoenix, breaking a 1-for-20 slump, and then missed every three he took the rest of the way. Evan Turner, I mean, he's just been at like 15% all season. Yeah. He is at 13.3% in January. 13.3% in January. And Marcus Smart is at 14.8. And those guys, like, they shoot threes. These are not guys who pass up jump shots. Like, Turner does sometimes. Smart, Bradley, they're not passing up jump shots. Bradley shouldn't. He's a good shooter. Smart should probably hold back on some of them. And like they need those guys to shoot better. And I think those guys will shoot better. Even Turner, like he was 28% coming into the season. Like that's really bad, but it's not like earth-shattering bad like he's been this year.
Every time Evan Turner takes a three, he should be suspended a game. Like that should be automatic. Take a three, sit a game. He should never, unless the shot – and even if the shot clock is going down, even at the end, and I don't even think I'm kidding here. I think I would rather take the shot clock violation than the essential live ball turnover that becomes the long rebound and fast break opportunity for other teams. That's how bad his shooting is. I trust Avery Bradley's shooting to come back. Marcus Smart, we can continue talking about that because that was a thing for him last year where he would take a bunch of bad threes and he would find a way to hit like some clutch threes. He seemed to find a way to hit them at the end of games so you would live with the bad ones early. But Evan Turner, man, I can't find any new ways to say he should stop shooting threes. It's just stop.
It's funny because you're talking about the end of the shot clock thing. He had one, I think it was during the Memphis game. It might not have been. Where he took a shot. It was like four seconds left on the shot clock. Like he had no choice but to shoot this thing. And of course he misses it. And Twitter erupts. Like, what is Evan Turner doing? Right. Why is he shooting three? And it's like, man, he had 4 seconds left on the shot clock. He literally had no choice but to shoot it. And people are just so programmed to be like, what is Evan Turner doing when he's shooting this three?
I'm raising my hand right now. I'm one of those people. He shot one, I want to say, against the Pacers. It was at the end of the second half, 2-for-1 situation, 30 seconds to go, somewhere in that range. Classic 2-for-1. He gets the ball on the wing, above the break, shoots the three, and I lose my mind. I'm like, what is he doing? Should never shoot it. I don't care if there's 22 seconds. Like, he's so early in the shot clock, people are like, it's a 2-for-1. Like, I don't care. I would rather give up the 2-for-1, work it around, and get a shot that at least has a prayer of going in. That's how the rules of basketball no longer apply to Evan Turner. Just don't shoot the ball. Even if, like, the only one scenario, 0.3 on the clock, the ball happens to find him. Do not pass him the ball in that situation. And we're down any amount of points, and he has no choice. That's our only hope to tie or win the game. And even then, I don't know. Like that's
you might just forfeit.
Even then, I might just shut it off. I'm not even going to watch it to see if it goes in. Because, I mean, if he hits it, that's like, it's only going to encourage him. I'd rather have him just miss and be like, see, I told you. Every time it goes in, I feel like an angel loses its wings.
Angels just dropping dead left
just
and
dropping
right.
Dropping left and right. They're like, no, falling from the sky. Evan Turner shaking their fist at him. So back to Marcus Smart. Sorry, we can't mention Evan Turner without. Hey, at least David Lee's not playing. So that's one rant out of the way.
There you go. No more David Lee rants. No. Although David Lee after the Memphis game. There could have been an epic David Lee rant. That was like peak David Lee struggles right there. He went
two for 12,
11 of the shots, 11 were from the restricted area. Like that is 3 feet and in.
Yeah.
And he went 2 for 11 on those shots. He was just botching wide open layups. And the sad part about it is, he was really close to a huge game. Like, if he had just finished layups, he could have had a huge game and maybe put himself back in the rotation. Instead, he goes 2 for 12, and he did not want to talk about that game after the game.
I wonder why.
He walked straight out of the locker room and walked straight out of the rotation at the same time. Has not been back since. He was funny with Powerball, man. He bought like $100 worth of tickets when Powerball got, I don't know, what was it, like $600 million the first time?
Uh-huh.
He bought $100 worth of tickets, was like all he would talk about in the locker room was Powerball and what he was going to do with the tickets when he won Powerball. And then it came back and he looked at the reporters and no joke. He looks at the reporters, and he had just had a DNP. I think this was after his first or second DNP, and he says, completely sarcastic, DNP, Brad? Doesn't matter if I win Powerball.
Are you kidding? kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he was very into Powerball.
Can't express how pissed off I would have been if David Lee had won the Powerball. That just would have been – I would rather have somebody walk up to me and kick me in the balls every day for the rest of the year than have David Lee win the Powerball.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to basketball. So we get some Twitter questions that's going to lead us into our discussions about the rotations because they seem to be solidifying. So let's get to Jan. How irritated is it that it took some embarrassing losses to make the decision, hey, let's try playing our best lineups?
See, I think all along the plan has been to go with these small lineups. I think Stevens has known from the start of the season, small lineups, Jarebko at the four, Crowder at the four, those are going to be our best lineups. He must have known because that was the formula last year, and it was very apparent from day one of the regular season that David Lee and some of those traditional big lineups were not going to be powerful. So I think he's known the whole time, and he's just kind of been waiting to unleash those because Avery Bradley was hurt. Marcus Smart was hurt. Those guys have kind of gone in and out of the lineup, and they don't have a lot of backcourt depth. They don't obviously trust James Young and RJ Hunter yet. They don't trust Terry Rozier. So rather than pile minutes on guys, they decided, you know what, we'll go with these traditional big lineups. And also, you have that whole dynamic, like, if they're playing, like, RJ Hunter instead of David Lee, that could be an issue. If they're playing Crowder and Bradley and Smart instead of David Lee, David Lee's like, you know what, those guys are better than I am. So there's a difference between playing that unproven rookie and playing the more established guy to the other guys, I think, who are out of the rotation and watching these guys play minutes. So Stevens has kind of been waiting to unleash those lineups. And I think he's known that they would be the best. He's talked about it all year long. These small lineups are going to be the best. The last couple of games, he unleashed that small Isaiah Thomas, Avery Bradley, Marcus Smart, Jay Crowder quartet, mostly with Amir Johnson, which I think we were talking about this at the beginning of the season, weren't we? When we were predicting like what the crunch time lineup would be. That was one of them. We were like, that one could be really good. And those four guards had, I'll throw Crowder in as a guard right now, just because it's easier to say four guards than three guards in a forward. But those four guards, they're all tough enough to guard up a position, and that obviously offensively that's one of their better lineups because it has so much skill, so much quickness, and Isaiah Thomas and Avery Bradley shooting once it returns from wherever the hell it's gone, and Amir Johnson, who has been fantastic for like 3 weeks now, so that's a good lineup. And amazingly, those four guards only played 21 minutes together last season. Obviously, they were only together after the All-Star break, but still, like, you'd expect them to get more. And then they'd hardly played at all this season until three games ago, I guess now. And Stevens unleashed a lineup, and then after the game, he said, you know what? Before yesterday's game, he said, you know what? I've always thought that was going to be one of our better lineups. We just haven't been able to play it yet. So he's kind of known. And he's just letting them get back to health, letting Smart play himself back into normalcy. And now it's like, I think his vision for what the team could be or maybe should be is finally like starting to unfold.
Well, it's about time. And injuries have been really the problem. I also think that part of the weight, in addition to the injuries, it's gathering information. It's November, December, getting the data and seeing and proving to guys, look, David Lee, you're going to be out of the rotation. And when he sits there and says, why? You have a sustainable amount of data behind the decision to say, look, every time you're in the game, you have a negative effect on the other players. You're a minus whatever every time you're in the game. So you have at least the data to back it up where if he pushes back, you can say, look, it's not working right now. We're going to go in a different direction. Stay ready. We might still need you, but this is why. You have answers to the inevitable question when the player says, why? But I still do really like when that lineup, and I get a lot of tweets about this on Twitter, like, finally, this is the thing we've been waiting for. It's so much fun. And just like you were talking about before, Marcus Smart, if you counter with a big lineup, if that small lineup comes out and you want to be, you say, well, we're just going to throw some size at them and see how they handle it. Well, Marcus Smart can handle the size. Jay Crowder can handle the size. And you put Amir Johnson out there, he can handle the size, obviously. And he's really good at protecting the rim. So you have – that's easily their best defensive lineup. That lineup is just amazingly great defensively.
Yeah, and one more thing I want to say about the lineups. I think Stevens genuinely wanted to make the big guys work. Like, he really wanted to make traditional lineups work because they have five established big guys who obviously have been good players in very recent years. So, like, Tyler Zeller was a starter last year and a solid one. David Lee has obviously been a very good player in his career. Like, they had five big guys with resumes, and he genuinely wanted to make that work. And he tried, and he tried, yeah. And he kept trying. And so I think that was a thing where he was, like, trying to bite the bullet maybe and see if they could make it work at some point. And then you get to the point where it's, like, halfway through the season, which basically they are right now. And you say, you know what, we tried, and these lineups didn't really work. And now it's time to go back to what we knew would work from day one, which are the small lineups.
Well, let's just get one more Twitter question in here. Not a question, but just kind of more of a comment. This comes from Nicholas O'Malley. Can the starting five get any shorter? If so, how long until it starts looking like the Toon Squad?
Sign Earl Boykins.
We can bring in Muggsy Bogues as a little man coach.
Move Marcus Smart to center and sign Earl Boykins. I'm all aboard that.
This question, are you concerned about the minutes load for Avery Bradley? He's played 38, 38, 41, and 38 since coming back. I found that to be an interesting question.
Yeah, I thought it was weird that he played 39 minutes against Phoenix because, you know, they sat Isaiah Thomas the whole fourth quarter. They clearly wanted to rest Amir Johnson. They are about to play their fourth game in five nights in Washington, D.C. against the Wizards on a road back-to-back, and Bradley was still accumulating minutes in the fourth quarter of a blowout, which was weird. And I don't know why. I guess it wasn't like that game was completely out of reach. Like, Phoenix cut it to 13 with 9 minutes or so left. So you can understand why they wanted their good players in there. But maybe it was partly to give Smart a better chance to have good point guarding, a good stretch of point guarding, because then you have Avery Bradley, the space from Avery Bradley. So I don't know. But yeah, that was especially weird, I thought, because the other games, you know, they were close games, and sometimes your good players are going to play a lot of minutes.
Sure. But he's coming off a hip injury.
Yes.
It was bothering him.
It was a bruise. Like, it's not like a thing where you worry about overuse, I think. But okay. Yeah.
You think any of it was just to maybe let's see if we can get Avery Bradley going and get some of those shots falling?
Yeah, maybe. That could be it too. Like here we're playing against a team that has an atrocious defense and has been letting everyone score the whole month. Like, please, Avery, get going. We need you to get going. But yeah, maybe that was it. Who knows? It was a good opportunity to get him going. Unfortunately, he did not get going. He still needs to get going. Finished 7 for 21 with 17 points. Very inefficient night for him. Although he did have some nice moves cutting the hoop. He had some a nice dish to Amir Johnson, rather, after a curl. So he did some good things. But they need him to start shooting well again. And timeout. We need to mention Jay Crowder. Jay Crowder, it's become normal. Right. Like, it's become normal.
And the reason we were waiting is because we have a question here from Justin.
Okay.
So let me get to that since you brought it up. And it's long. But he says, let me start by saying the obvious. There will never be another KG. That said, I like to think Jay Crowder is as close to KG for our current Celtics in terms of heart, passion, pride, hustle, never giving up, playing all out. Every game he plays, unique guy with a range of tools. So the question there is, if you had to build around a current Celtic, would it be Jay? If not, who's your pick and why? So let's dovetail into some Jay Crowder discussion, because I think, to quickly kind of answer that question, he's one of the key pieces to the future. They've locked him up for that reason, and he's way outperformed his contract,
is a 5-year deal, which could look unbelievable by the time that's all said and done. To have that guy locked up for $7 million a year after the salary cap goes bonkers is going to be such a steal.
He's going to be in those pieces, that annual piece, the best contracts, worst contracts in the NBA. I think he's a lock to be in that best contract in the NBA. Not the best, but one of the best, because of what he's doing and being a two-way player. It's amazing. So, but yeah, I mean, Crowder had against the Pacers. How awesome was he against the Pacers? He did everything: driving, shooting, defense. It was such an amazing game.
Yeah, I mean, he gave Paul George fits until George went, except for that little third quarter span when George went wild. Crowder's numbers during January. This is a guy who everyone thought was just a defensive player, a throw into the Rondo trade. This is a guy who nobody thought would become a plus shooter, at least as quickly. January, month of January, 8 games, 18.4 points per game, 4.9 rebounds, 2.4 steals. He is shooting 49% from the field and 39.5% from three-point range on more than 5 attempts per game. He is getting to the line almost 5 times, which is far and away second best on the Celtics behind Isaiah Thomas. He has done so much on both ends. He can play 3. He can play 4. The Celtics offense during the month of January is 7 points better with him on the court. He has just been really, really, really good.
Yeah. He's shooting lights out. He's got a true shooting percentage of 62% for the month of January, which is amazing. But you know what? It carries. His true shooting was at 60% in December. It's not like December.
I need to correct myself, by the way. Sorry. I said the offense was 7 points better. 7 points better than its average. When he's off the court, the Celtics score this month have scored 82.9 points per 100 possessions. When he's on the court, they scored 108.7. So that's 26-ish points better, if my math is correct. I'm not great at math.
It's close enough. I'm not even thinking about trying to correct you there. But look, you go back to December, which is 14 games in December. The numbers are very similar. 16 points, 6 rebounds. The steal numbers were there. His usage has gone up in January, and he's produced. So the more he's been used, the better he's played. And that's kind of the trend. His usage has gone up every month of the season, And every month of the season, his numbers just continue to get better. So I think they're in a nice sweet spot with him. This is a nice amount of time for him to play, a good amount of minutes, a good amount of touches. Like, this is, if we can keep this Jay Crowder, this is perfect. Like, this is I love it.
Yeah, and he's become really, really good.
Now, I don't know, with all-star consideration, I think Isaiah Thomas is the guy that will probably get in. I don't think if the Celtics are still, right now they're eighth in the conference, if they're still in that playoff hunt, the coaches are going to have to pick a Celtic. I think the way the Celtics have played this year, they are deserving of an all-star, at least. So the question is, are there so many good guards that Isaiah Thomas might get left off? And would Jay Crowder be considered at the forward spot? I mean, he's playing so well. The answer to my own question, I think, is Isaiah Thomas is the guy, and I don't think they would pick anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, but
normally when you have a guy like Jay Crowder, who, as well as he's played, as much as he's improved, he's still kind of a role player. And to be a role player on the All-Star team, you normally have to be on, you know, that team that's on pace for 55 or 60 wins. And that's just how it is. And obviously he's been really good at both ends of the court. But that's just, it's not really how the All-Star game works. I'd be really, really shocked if Jay Crowder makes the All-Star team. I would not be shocked if Isaiah Thomas makes it. Okay. I think Thomas should make it. Yeah.
I think that's right. All right, let's transition here.
But at the same time, I'm not convinced. I think I tweeted this a couple weeks ago. You could probably convince me Crowder has been the Celtics' best player this season, given everything, offense, defense, his versatility. You could convince me that.
All right. You know what? I'll make this comparison. I hesitate to do it, but let's look. It's almost like Golden State Warriors-ish in that Steph Curry is clearly their best player, most important player. But you could argue that Draymond Green is really their most important player, because when Draymond does so many different things, we've had this discussion before. Like, obviously, it's Steph Curry.
Yeah.
But Draymond Green has how many triple-doubles? When he's playing well, that team, he has a positive impact on everybody's offense. And he's defending the rim at 6.5 feet tall, and he's doing so many unique things. Go now apply it to the Celtics. Obviously, when Isaiah Thomas, look, the last show we were talking, Isaiah Thomas was struggling, and the Celtics were in the midst of a losing streak, and it looked terrible. So when Isaiah Thomas isn't playing well, there's no getting over that. But when Jay Crowder is playing like this, you can make that argument that he's the most important player on this team, with the offense going like it was. Go back to the Pacers game, defending Paul George. Throw that little stretch out, because Paul George is so good that he's every superstar player is going to have like a little stretch. It's guarding him in the clutch moments early in the game, not letting him get going at the start, and not letting him take over at the finish. Those are the most important things. And just playing that two-way game, that's hugely important for the Celtics. So, yeah, Isaiah Thomas gets hot, but when Jay Crowder is on top of that doing this stuff, then he has such a positive impact on everybody's game. So I think it's a very similar type of dynamic.
Yeah, I think while we're on the topic of All-Star stuff, and I think it Isaiah Thomas obviously has a strong case. He's playing great basketball. He's so important to what the Celtics do. They need him. I think if you look at the voting, he may need Kyrie Irving to drop out of like the starters. Because if Kyrie Irving, who has barely played this season, makes it as a starter, then that makes him, Dwayne Wade, are going to be the starters. Then it's Kyle Lowry, Jimmy Butler, John Wall, DeMar DeRozan, all those guys are guards in the East. That's a lot of guards.
Yeah.
So
who do you leave off?
Exactly. You know? So you look at the numbers of that, and he may need Lowry to pass Irving so that then Irving isn't a lock. And I don't think Irving should make the team. Maybe David Blatt would put him on anyway, but it's interesting. I think it'll be close with Isaiah Thomas, whether he's an all-star or not, which is crazy because he's had such a good season.
Yeah.
And he's doing it playing winning basketball.
This is just there's so many good point guards in the league that somebody is going to get left off, and somebody really, really good, and an all-star level player is not going to be an all-star because there are just so many good guards. So I hope Isaiah makes it. He definitely deserves to make it. There's no doubt about that. But we'll have to see how the voting goes and what the coaches think. All right. This is the part of the show I think that everybody wants to really, really talk about. Trade talk. Trade deadline's coming up. It's, what, 4.5 weeks away now at this point? So ESPN came out with their list of three most tradable guys and whatever. They put their list together of the players that teams should pursue. And, of course, it's the same crap that Boogie Cousins at the top and Rudy Gay and Hassan Whiteside for the Celtics. Now, can we just get over the DeMarcus Cousins thing? He is not getting traded, which I know saying this on the show means he's definitely getting traded. He is not getting traded. If you really listen to what's going on in the league, you hear like Zach Lowe passed along the story of Vlade Divac not even returning phone calls. GMs are calling the Sacramento Kings, and he's just not calling them back. And we talked about this in the last show, I think. That's just pay attention. They have an arena opening next year. They are still in the playoff hunt. In fact, I'm going to pull up they are right now at 16-23. They are one game out of the eighth seed in the West. They need wins. They need excitement. They need a playoff run to get butts in the seats, to make some money, and open up the next year, the new building next year, with some excitement, with some momentum. You don't do that by trading away your best player. The guy is in the top five in scoring and rebounding. He is if he wasn't such a head case, there wouldn't be any discussion of this. They need him to be in Sacramento to give Kings fans some hope for the future. They are not trading him now. They might trade him in a couple years when they still haven't won and he's a free agent, and there's talk about him not re-signing, and he might be that guy that they trade away in a Carmelo Anthony-esque way. But not now. Not now. We need to get Cousins out of our minds. So who's the realistic trade target out there? Who can the Celtics go and make a call for? Is it Ryan Anderson? Is it Danilo Gallinari? Those are names that I would be more interested in. So, Jay, Here's the question. We know Ryan Anderson's a free agent.
Yeah.
With the salary cap going up, this is unlike any other atmosphere in the NBA that we've seen. Everybody's going to have cap space. And much more cap space moving forward. Like that's almost meaningless. That everybody's going to have money and that means nothing anymore. Is it better to trade for a guy like Ryan Anderson and try to lock him up and not let him hit free agency, then say, I'm not giving you assets for a free agent. I'm just going to sign him outright when everybody's going to have the money to pursue him.
I mean, probably not worth giving up assets for a guy like Ryan Anderson, who will be a free agent and who's not like that pivotal piece. Who is going to make, like, it'd be one thing if you traded did the Knicks thing where they traded for Carmelo Anthony, who is obviously a cornerstone. It's another thing when you trade for an impending free agent and he's a guy like Ryan Anderson, who, as good a shooter as he is from the four position, is a replaceable guy and really like not going to be one of your top three or four players. So I wouldn't want to give up assets for a guy like that at the trade deadline. There's no way I would want to do that, especially like you never know what he's going to do. You never know what your roster is going to look like because you're going to be going after the top stars. You're going to be going after those big trades where you're targeting stars, and you never know whether Ryan Anderson is going to fit and where he's going to fit in the future roster. So if they target him in free agency after they determine who they might be able to target and what else is going on, yeah, sure. But to me, making a move like that would be short-sighted. And he's the type of guy you target once you figure out what you're doing with the rest of the roster, I think.
Okay. I like Gallinari.
Yeah, Gallinari is good, but you know, I'm sure Denver likes Gallinari.
Right. But the question about Denver is what are they doing? Where are they?
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things, like if we're looking at trade targets, like I'm just looking at Denver at 15 and 25 and scuffling and look, at some point you have to hit the reset button, which we all like to say blow it up, but it's not easy to do. Denver is in a position where they've got a guy in Gallinari that's good. There's some injury issues, but he still can be a hell of a player and the type of scorer that the Celtics need. And he's locked up for a couple of years. I mean, he's got a player option for the 2017-18 season. So basically you get him for next year. If he continues, then with the cap going up, he's almost certainly going to opt out, but at least you have his bird rights and you can kind of make a decision from there. So that's why I bring up Gallinari, to try and look at a realistic situation. Celtics need, Denver need, maybe there's something that they can
do. Gallinari would absolutely help the Celtics. If I can interject, I don't think I've ever told this story on the podcast before.
No.
So when I was in college, I went to Skidmore College. The New York Knicks held training camp at my school, and I was on the basketball team. I was very bad for the basketball team, which was a really bad basketball team. But I was ball boy for the New York Knicks, and this was a year, I think it was Gallinari's rookie season, and he had back issues, and he wasn't allowed to play in training camp. One day, this rookie, who was like mysterious, nobody really knew, or at least I didn't know, like I'd heard he was really talented, whatever. He comes out, starts shooting, right hand, makes like 90% of threes, like just whap, 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 whap. I'm like, man, this dude, he's like 6'10". He can shoot the hell out of the basketball. He switches hands.
Get out.
Lefty. Whap, 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 whap. I'm telling you, hit like 85% of his three-pointers left-handed. I'm looking at this thing like, what the hell? who the hell is this 6'10 Italian guy? Like, just wedding jumpers with his offhand. It was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in my life. Like, just this rookie that completely mysterious comes in offhand jumpers. So yeah, that's my Danilo Gallinari story. That was unbelievable to see. Like, that was just crazy. And that was when I knew, like, okay, yeah, NBA players, those are different types of dudes than the normal basketball player. Because at that, I mean, it took him years to get good. It took him years even to become a good shooter in the NBA. And he was never missing with either hand that day. That Knicks team, by the way, was incredible. The things I saw in that training camp. So Stephon Marbury, he had the Starbury shoes, like the $10 shoes.
Yeah.
One day he's going through the paint. The sole falls right off. So, of course, they're the New York Knicks. They forgot to bring his backup pair of shoes. So Marbury's going around asking all the ball boys, who are my teammates and myself, what size you? Can I wear your shoes? And nobody had the right size. I think he was 11 and a half. And so he had to sit out the rest of practice and sat there on the bench in his socks.
Oh, my God.
Jerome James asked my teammate during the middle of practice if my teammate would go get him a ham sandwich. A ham sandwich. Like, this team was the biggest bunch of knuckleheads. It was like Jerome James, Eddie Curry, Marbury, Nate Robinson. It was like bunch of knuckleheads. And man, I wish everyone could experience one training camp with those Knicks, because it was absolutely incredible to see just the extent of their knuckleheadedness.
That is amazing. We're going to do like a separate podcast, just you telling stories from that training camp.
I could go forever like that.
No, we're going to do it.
And one day I talked to David Lee about it, because he was on that team. And he was like, man, those were some weird days.
All right. So we'll save this. This is like a tease. This is going to get people back for the podcast. Occasionally, we're going to take a break and we're going to sit back and listen to Jay tell another story from that fateful Knicks training camp so many years ago. All right, let's move on to continuing the trade talk, because we're asked by Ryan Kennedy, who would you unload off the roster and who is untouchable? So it depends, obviously, on the trade. I would say, obviously, depending on the trade, no one is untouchable.
Yeah,
Isaiah Thomas is available for the right deal.
Although you did call Kelly Olynyk pretty untouchable earlier, and I think you also said he could be the perfect player. So
he could be.
You might have been going a little over the top. Kelly Olynyk being the perfect player.
Look, I've explained this before. Obviously, he's not untouchable. Everybody is available. I think Kelly Olynyk can be the type of player that if everything goes well, this is all about his potential. If he keeps going and does this on a regular basis, then he becomes the type of player that every team would want. Look, a stretch five with his ability is really important. That's the type of player that everybody wants in today's NBA. So I wouldn't include Olynyk in the type of deal. Like, if you sit there and say Sullinger and Lee and, you know, Zeller, like those guys, you're trying to throw, like, Sullinger's got some potential. He's a restricted free agent. You can kind of keep him around. Same with Zeller. And you throw David Lee in a pick, like that middle level deal type of thing. Like, that's Olynyk is not in that level deal for me. Like, I put Olynyk in the type of trade that if you're going to make a deal that involves Isaiah Thomas, like that level deal, like, to me, Olynyk is in that stratosphere trade-wise. I think he's that valuable because of what he can become. It's not like he's just a stretch four. He's got so many skills that could develop into something special. So that's why I say that. So yeah, Isaiah Thomas is available, but that's like a superstar deal. Same with Jay Crowder. They would I think Jay Crowder is more untouchable than Isaiah Thomas. He's less replaceable than Isaiah Thomas. But I think that's nitpicking, because either of those guys, if we were to move either of those guys, it would be in a top, like, Durant level deal. Right, I mean, we're trading those guys only for the guy.
Yeah. I mean, those guys aren't going anywhere unless the Celtics can get a really, really, really good player.
Right. So, but the point is that they are available for that player. Everybody on this team is available for the right price. There's no one here that they want to. They're going to hold out. There are guys that they want to hold on to. And for different reasons, I'm sure, like, Jordan Mickey is not going to be a throw-in type of deal. because they really like what he's doing, and I think they want to see him develop. So if a team sits there and says, well, and to make the money work, we'll just take Jordan Mickey, I don't think that's going to fly for the Celtics. Like, he's not a throw-in type of player. That raises his value a little bit. So, I mean, if we're ranking the types of players, I think Isaiah Thomas, Crowder, Smart is up in that realm. Kelly Olynyk, Avery Bradley, are in the top five of untouchable players.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, I agree with you there. I would say I'm interested to see what they do with their bigs, because obviously you have Tyler Zeller, who has barely played all season. He's a restricted free agent at the end of the season. Obviously, I mean, you have to at least look into what you could get for him or what his value is. David Lee, same thing. I don't think too many guys will be clamoring for his service, but he's another guy that clearly you're not against trading. So I'm really interested to see what they do with the bigs. And, you know, Danny Ainge has said they're not just looking for stars, they're looking for upgrades. And so this could be a neat trade deadline, because, you know, last year they went out and got Isaiah Thomas, which came together literally last second right before the trade deadline. And, you know, if they can pull off something similar to that, like some heist where they get a difference maker, if they get another player at the level of Isaiah Thomas. Obviously not, he wasn't an established star at the time. He's becoming one, but that changed them.
Let me throw out a name. Brooke Lopez.
First of all, I don't think the Nets are going to have a fire sale. From what Prokhorov was saying the other day, where he's delusional and wants to compete for a title, I don't think they'll have a fire sale. Who knows? I mean, they are in such disarray. To fire your GM, who kind of was like, had his hands tied building the roster. Like, they forced him, right, to go out and kind of mortgage the future?
Yes. They forced him to make win-now trades, but he could have made much better win-now trades.
I mean, at the time, you get Pearson Garnett. You have Darren Williams, who, at the time, people thought he was a star, you know? And they had Brook Lopez, Joe Johnson, who had not yet fallen off a cliff. And they signed Kirilenko for dirt cheap. Like, that looked like a great move at the time. None of it panned out. No. And so, I mean, yeah, in retrospect, that trade looks like one of the worst in NBA history.
Look, I can see them going after Pearson Garnett to try and toughen up their team and get some leadership, but they gave up four picks, basically. The three outright and that one switch. They gave up control of their picks for the next 5 years.
Yeah, I don't mean to defend the trade. The trade, one of the worst ever. But I do believe ownership forced him to make a win-now type of trade. And there aren't a lot of win-now, like, go-for-championship type of trades you can make. So, I don't know. I don't know if Billy King's any good at his job. I don't know how much was on him. I really don't know. But I do know that firing your GM a month before the trade deadline shows all sorts of craziness. And, like, that is not an organization that can be trusted. And for the Celtics, that is fantastic. But it also, you never know what they're going to do. Are they going to go out and, like, who knows? Like, are they going to trade Joe Johnson to try to sacrifice their future again to, like, take on bad contracts with better players, though? I don't know. That's like the type of deal that could hurt the Celtics, because they do own those draft picks in the next 3 years. So I'm interested to see what the Nets will do. They're in bad shape regardless, but they could put themselves in a little better shape for the near future I guess, which would hurt the Celtics.
I don't see them being able to move Joe Johnson, but who knows?
But I mean, he's an expiring, and if you take on like two pretty bad contracts, I don't know what it would be, like two pretty bad contracts that.
Yeah, but the salary cap
pretty good players.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, clear cap space and all of that stuff.
Yeah, there aren't that many bad contracts for like helpful players.
Right, and the salary cap's going up, so everybody's getting cap space anyway. So that type of deal is much less likely, I think. Look, I'm not saying go get Brook Lopez, but this is a team that, to me, trying to think about it rationally, the way you fix the Brooklyn Nets is you start trying to acquire as many draft picks as you can. So it's not even, from Brooklyn's perspective, it's not even about the return. It's about getting picks. So if the Celtics were to give up the Dallas pick, you know, keep their own, keep the Brooklyn pick. You're not giving Brooklyn any of their picks back. But if you sit there and you say, here's the Dallas pick, here's the Minnesota pick, which will probably be 2 seconds, and here's a pick in 2017, maybe Boston's own pick in 2017, thinking that it's going to be a lower first rounder. Because, again, we can – well, no, wait, we're switching. Never mind. But something, a future pick somehow. And then you say, here's Lee, here's Sullinger, here's Zeller. We'll take Lopez. You've got some young players that you can look at, but more importantly, you're getting picks and you're back in this draft. Like that to me, from Brooklyn's perspective, that's something that would be appealing from a rational perspective, not the win now perspective. And that would obviously clear away three bigs. You get back one and you have a little bit more identity. I don't know. Just something that I'm throwing out there. So,
I think you're thinking too rationally.
That's the first time anybody's ever accused me of that.
But also, it would be hysterical, absolutely hysterical, if the Brooklyn Nets, after trading their entire future to the Celtics, then went on and traded Brook Lopez to the Celtics.
I know. That would be amazing.
That would be high comedy.
Okay. I want to go on a little bit of a rant.
Uh-oh. We've made it this far without a real John rant, but here it comes.
Why don't the Celtics wear their classic green road uniforms anymore? I think they've worn them once this season, and that was a home game, the home opener. Why don't they wear their classic green with the white Celtics across the chest anymore?
I just started coughing. Those jerseys make me sick, obviously.
What?
I can't stand the sleeves. I can't stand... although, I must say, Hickory High Pacers jerseys, I almost went into the locker room and stole one. It was really tough for me not to go in there and steal an Ollie jersey, because I need that in my life. I need to represent Hickory High.
You're pro Hickory High jerseys.
Only because of Hoosiers. I mean, those are gross, gross jerseys.
Right.
But just the fact that they're representing Hoosiers, a movie about it. I believe it was a 1953 Indiana high school team. And that makes me very happy. That's obviously one of my favorite movies. I used to, the day before every season, I would watch Hoosiers to just get fired, even more fired up for the upcoming season. Every single year I watched Hoosiers before the first game of the year, and then slept in my jersey because I was a weirdo and had read that someone had done it. I think it was Jason Terry. Like, Jason Terry used to sleep in his jersey, and I was a kid, and so I used to sleep in my jersey too.
Oh, isn't that sweet? It still doesn't answer my question about the Celtics not wearing their goddamn classic Boston Celtics road uniforms. Like, I get the occasional alternate uniform. You want to throw it out there. Hey, reminder people, you can buy this. But the Celtics have road uniforms and home uniforms. They are classic. They are timeless. They are the Boston Celtics. And they've just completely abandoned them. All of your classic photos from all across history have some, it's either the word Celtics or the word Boston on the front, but basically it's the same thing. Bill Russell wore them. John Havlicek wore them. Larry Bird, Paul Pierce. You can go through the annals of time. Road games have the same road jersey. And now, that jersey that they're wearing now, it's okay. It's an alternate. It's okay. But they're making that their standard road jersey, and I hate it.
All across history, through the annals of time.
Should I have done a more dramatic voice with that?
John Corrales is angry. That was a strong rant. 70s.
I mean, seriously, though, come on. Tell me I'm wrong here. This is crap. This is crap. But yeah. I said on Twitter that I'm going to get over the uniform thing. This is my last rant. I have to let it go because clearly, like, the sleeve jerseys are here. These alternates are here. I like some of the alternates. The St. Patrick's Day jerseys that they had with the gold lettering, I love those. I like those coming out every once in a while. But I just want the classic road uniforms back. I want the Celtics to be the Celtics.
I'm usually a traditionalist when it comes to jerseys. I just want all teams to go back to like the mid-90s jerseys where the Rockets had like the red and gold and
those big ugly raptor, big purple dinosaur.
Yeah, bunny. Yeah. Those were like that was the peak of jerseys, I would say.
And through the Celtics wore their regular green jerseys.
Yeah.
Even through that madness, they didn't fall victim.
Until now. And now they fell victim. But at least they've won two straight, John. So they've got that going for them. And all across history, through the annals of time.
All right. Okay, so that'll be a good place to wrap it up. I hate to wrap it up on a serious note, a sad note, but we should mention this, that we do want to make note of the passing of Andrew Smith, because it's such an important thing to the Celtics and Brad Stevens, but just an important thing because this was a good guy, not just a good basketball player, a good guy who lost his life way too young at 25 years old. So I know, Jay, you saw Brad get emotional.
That was heart-wrenching.
About Andrew Smith, that's how important he was. It's just this dose of humanity.
Yeah, that was heart-wrenching. Obviously, he touched so many people's lives. And I think the fact that Stevens is giving the eulogy at the funeral is incredible. I don't know about you, but I never, ever, ever got near that close with one of my coaches. For him to be that close with one of his former players, I think speaks so highly of the type of relationships that he does build with his players. Because I couldn't imagine. I don't think if I passed away, honestly, I would be surprised if any of my coaches would even show up to the funeral. Never mind give a eulogy.
Well.
And so honestly, like that is incredible, and it speaks to the relationships he has. Yeah. And Andrew Smith, prayers go out to his family. Cancer sucks, man. Yeah. Cancer really, really sucks. And now his wife, who's 24, has to deal with that. A lot of people who loved him have to deal with that. And from the sound of it, he was just a tough, tough kid who always, always cared about everyone else first. And you could see it on the basketball court. He cared about everyone else first. And that was just really, really, really heart-wrenching and touching to see Stevens' reaction and the tears that he had to hold back when he was talking about Andrew Smith and how touched he obviously was by this kid's life. Because even in short life, you touch so many people. And that's why I love sports, man, because they bring people together. Yeah. They bring people together. I'm still, most of my best friends are guys I played basketball with back in the day. And so power of sports, bring people together. Thoughts and prayers go out to Andrew Smith. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's sad. And, you know, life is fleeting. Things can change in an instant. So just, I hope everybody takes a moment to kind of appreciate some of the things that they have. You know, call your mom, give somebody a hug, just kind of take the moment and appreciate it while you have it. Thanks, everybody. We will be back with more basketball next week. More positive talk, we hope. And we'll see you next week on the Rain and Jays podcast.
The new iPhone?
Yeah, got it on T-Mobile. Fastest iPhone deserves America's fastest LTE network.
Introducing the amazing iPhone 8. It's the best iPhone yet, now on America's best unlimited network. For a limited time, save up to $300 on the amazing iPhone 8 after 24 monthly bill credits. And now join T-Mobile's iPhone upgrade program for free.
Eligible trade-in and finance agreement required. If you cancel service, you may lose promo credits. Contact us for details. Video at 480p. Small fraction of users over 50 gigs per month may have reduced speed. See store for details.